everyone. Welcome to another episode of Sounds from the 70s with Gary and Rob, also referred to in France as Les Poupées.
Les Poupées.
And we are coming to you from the dusty hills of Oklahoma, or as I call it, the Ozarks. For legal purposes, we are not actually taping in Oklahoma. Now, this week's show is so exciting. Oh, Rob, it's so exciting.
I thought it would be.
It should not even be allowed to be taped. We shouldn't even be taping this show. It's too much.
We need Valium. That will calm us right down.
Because this show is so good today. So, I swear to God, this show is so good today. But we're going to do it anyways, because what else are we going to do?
We're here. Everything's set up.
We're going to do the show. We have been warned not to do the show too good.
Yeah.
But we will.
It would be an insult to all the people involved in putting on the show not to do it.
Yes, the whole crew. On today's show, we will be featuring another glam rock artist from the 1970s. And today it is the English band Sweet, or as they say in France, Les Sweet.
Les Sweet. I saw that one coming.
Did you?
Les Sweet.
Yeah, I don't even know if that's right. We could get letters about that.
Could be
actually, it is not pronounced a Les Sweet. It's pronounced a Les Sucre.
Well, maybe not by the hip kids.
And we will be reviewing their 1974 album, Desolation Boulevard. I just want to remind people, I know this is only the end of... Oh, no, I thought I had a joke for that. Maybe it's in the upcoming section.
It probably is.
I had a joke for that. Anyways, I just want to remind people, and I was saying before, I interrupted myself so rudely. This is only the end of November, taping-wise, even though we're taping this show in May.
What year? You guess.
But in 3 weeks, we will be airing our fourth annual Christmas special.
Rockin'.
And this year, we will be tentatively, which means we're calling people. We haven't signed them yet. Rob, we haven't signed these people on the
because we put on the big Christmas extravaganza every year, and we invite all sorts of people who used to be famous at one time.
Yeah, washed up people, yeah.
Yeah.
And so we will tentatively be having on the show, this is what we have on tap. If it doesn't come through, don't blame us. Blame the performer.
Blame the performer. No inviting dead people this year.
Anyways, we'll be having on the show comedian Foster Brooks again.
Foster.
He was on our first Christmas special. Well, he really wasn't, because we had to bump him. But he was filled in for our first special. And you know what? I was watching YouTube. And I was watching some Foster Brooks stuff. And you know what? He does this thing where he's drunk. And it's really funny. In fact, not only did he do this bit where he's drunk, his whole thing was about being drunk. He took up the whole 60 minutes by being drunk. And I just thought that's brilliant.
What a gig. If I had thought of that, I would be doing it right now.
And I bet the next show he did... He did the same thing. He just did it like he was drunk. And I just think that's comedy genius. Anyways, we're contacting Foster Brooks again to be on the show. We will have celebrity impressionist Fred Travellina, and he will do celebrity impressions, hence the word celebrity impressionist.
He doesn't change tires. He does celebrity impressions.
Oh, he does impressions, and... He'll be doing topical stuff like Bob Hope and...
Okay.
And maybe Robert Redford, you know, the people like that.
Last time he did Clark Gable.
And we got a special surprise this year. We are planning on having the one and only Charo Hakuchi on the show. Now, I know that Rob has trouble with Charo. Because they had a, sort of an affair a long time ago that turned out bad. But we're going to try and see if we can work in the same premises as Charo.
Such a beautiful package filled with so much crazy. crazy.
Yeah, you two are funny together, though. We were going to book Steve Lawrence, the great, underrated Steve Lawrence, but his agent was very rude. So I said to him, smell you later. That's right. I told Steve Lawrence, his agent, to smell you later.
Smell you later. You don't know if he's going to smell something or you're expected to smell something, so it's big.
I threw him off with that. I threw him off with that shot, I think. So there will not be any Steve Lawrence this year. I can't remember. I thought we had Steve Lawrence last year, but he got bumped again.
Yeah, I don't think he was ever actually here. It was always only just
talk. Oh, you know what? He got held up at the airport. That's right. I remember. I should remember these things.
Missed it's the whole Christmas show, but I bet he had a wonderful Christmas.
At the well, airport. He flew right back to Los Angeles. No idea.
Why would he fly this far just to visit our airport?
So that will be 3 weeks from today, Rob. Do you know what 3 weeks from today is? Three weeks from today is what it is.
A special holiday, Christmas time, super party.
Yes. In fact, we recommend that that week that we air the show, which will be about December 15th, you take the whole week off from work because your mind will be so blown. You won't be able to do your job correctly.
Yeah, it's one of those shows that it'll give you a whole new outlook on life.
Not necessarily a good one.
Yeah, and it'll take you 3 days to abandon that new outlook and go back to the old outlook.
Yeah. Maybe. It blows the mind, like I said. Actually, you could have just said it blows the mind, like I said, and it would have done the same thing.
I could have, but what if it blows the socks off as well as the mind?
Speaking of not doing the job correctly, Rob, how was your week?
Oh, by golly, on my week, there were no aliens. There were no airplane crashes near me. Wars have been fought, won and lost. But not near
me. You're supposed to say for real. Like people know when you say aliens or not. Like they're gonna know you're bullshit.
Well, I worked a few days, then a few days off, then a few days, then a few days off. See, that's quick. That's really fast.
I gotta fill it. Didn't I tell you about pauses when you're broadcasting?
I gotta fill it with something.
Didn't I tell you about that? Maybe I gotta use my high Richard Harris voice. But
on Friday I worked. On Saturday.
See, that's funny.
I did not work.
That's funny.
On Sunday, employment was thought about, but not acted out.
I find that funny. You see what I mean? That's why it's funny. You just don't say, and then it worked, and then it worked, and then it worked, and then expect people to laugh. That's not funny.
One of these days, I'll actually have something prepared when you ask me, because every time it catches me off guard. Every time.
Odds and ends. Lost time is not found again. Now, last episode on Odds and Ends, no, not last episode on Odds and Ends, but last episode, we told you that we would look up the David Boy Best Buy series of releases, and we did. And we also said we would look up Rob's outrageous assertion that the Who's Quadrophenia album did not have a booklet when he bought it in the early 80s.
That is correct, sir.
Now, we will tell you what we found out in next week's episode. So stay tuned. We're just kidding. We are jokesters. What I found out, I was surprised with the David Bowie Best Buy series. They were, I guess, the Best Buy series from RCA, which is bullshit. If you didn't hear last week's episode.
Yeah, Best Buy is a euphemism for bullshit series.
Started in 1980. I'm surprised because I didn't know that Ziggy Stardust was bought so late, 1980. I thought it was bought like in 1979 sometime, but I guess it must have been bought by my brother in very early 1980. Anyways, if you don't know what the Best Buy series is, the Best Buy series is you buy the album and you get a couple of bucks off, so instead of like $6.99 it's $4.99, but they take out all the guts of the record. All you basically gets the record and the sleeve and the album cover. Well, you get the back album cover too, but you don't get a gatefold or anything like that. So and most of the things I bought from David Bowie were like, this is just in Canada, by the way. They didn't have the Best Buy series, I don't think, in the States. Maybe they did. Who gives a shit? What I'm talking about is the Best Buy series. And not that I don't give a shit about the States. It's just that this is my complaint. And if it's in the States, then you know what? I'm all for railing against them too.
Yeah, it was a grand screwing then.
But like I bought like all of these albums on Best Buy, because like I bought like David Bowie albums like within a whole bunch within 3 years. Like I bought the Heroes album. And you know, the Heroes album only came with an inner sleeve originally, which they charged like $7 for, with just like the credits and song titles and then lyrics on the back. And then when they release it, they put the credits on the back of the album cover, and then there's no inner sleeve, so there's no lyrics. That's it. It's not like there was a gatefold. It's like, fuck you, why can't you just put the lyrics in there? Why can't you spend an extra buck and put the lyrics in there?
When Sgt. Pepper's, they put the lyrics
on. I'm not talking about Sgt. Pepper's. What the hell am I talking about Sgt. Pepper's for?
You're talking about lyrics on album covers.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about reissues. If you bought a reissue any time of the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's, or the White Album, you buy the White Album like I got for my birthday, which changed my life in 1977. It had all the stuff that you bought in 1968 when it first came out. Because the Beatles are a class organization, you son of a bitch. But I'm telling you, these record companies, that they come out, they had Diamond Dogs. Diamond Dogs had this from David Bowie, had this wraparound cover and gatefold and all this stuff. And when I bought it, what it was, a gatefold all of a sudden became the back cover. Bullshit. And then I got no lyrics or nothing, blah, blah, yeah. blah. And then I bought, what was the other one? Rob, what was the other one?
God. It was the other David Bowie album he did.
I don't know. Well, there was Ziggy Stardust, like I said. Scary Monsters I bought right when it was released.
Therefore, it still had the non-best.
Yes, of course. It had it was my first David Bowie album that I bought when it was first released. And it had all the packaging and the lyrics, and it was fantastic. And
wow, he should have done this sooner.
And he bought me, and it cost me an extra, like, it probably didn't cost me anything because usually they were on sale the first week or so. So it probably cost the same amount of money. Oh my God, it cost so much money to put freaking lyrics on. Because he didn't have those albums in the late 70s. He didn't have like a lot of stuff with them.
You know what they should have included those Best Buy series is a record company executive urine. Because they just piss all over the albums. That's what they should have done.
Don't get crude.
Don't go blue. It makes me so angry.
It is. Well, that makes me angry. I was the one who bought it. I was the one who bought all those albums. And Hunky Dory, too. My brother bought Hunky Dory, and it was a Best Buy series. Fuck them. And we bought a lot of albums, David Bowie albums, in like 2 or 3 years. Like, seriously, I'm talking about all those albums. I'm talking about, I bought Space Oddity, my first David Bowie album, in 79. I know it was the summer of 79. And then all those other albums happened from 1980 on, and they happened quickly, like Hunky Dory and Ziggy Stardust and Diamond Dogs and Scary Monsters and Low and Heroes and the live album Stage. And didn't buy Lodger for some reason because I just don't know why. I just didn't have the money. And then, of course, Let's Dance came out. And Let's Dance came out 83? By that time, between 1980 and the time Les Dance came out in 1983, I already had bought like 7 or 8 albums in that short period of time. Wow. So you can tell that I'm a little bit of a David Bowie fan.
When you find an artist you like, I mean, that's the one thing we had in common discussed years ago, is that the...
Oh, Station to Station I also bought too. So that's 9 albums I bought in like 3 years.
You want to collect all their stuff and see what they...
You do. I always did. Yeah. I've always... That's one thing that, like Rob just said, that we've always had in common is that I'm not just satisfied, or we're not just satisfied with just getting one album of somebody we like. It's like, as soon as you get it, and you relate to that music, you want to get the rest. I told that story about Roxy Music, how when I got their first album, and it just blew me away, that I bought the rest of them. Of course, I can't do that. I couldn't do that. This is how sad my life is. I couldn't do that at the time because I was a kid and had no money.
Yeah.
And I can't do that now because I'm an adult and I have no money. But gradually, like, you wait a couple months and you get another one, then you wait a couple months and then you get a couple. Yeah. And it was always important to That's what this show is about, to show all sides of the artist. And I wanted to see all sides of the artist. I wanted to see, especially with a guy like Bowie, who had so many sides. And even in the 70s alone, we're probably going to review quite a few albums because he had so many different forms of music he used in those 10 years that were just mind-boggling. Oh, and the second point, which is Rob's crazy assertion, that the Who's Quadrophenia album did not have a booklet when he bought it in the early 80s, is in fact true. After the first pressing, they stopped putting the book into the... I can understand that. It is a gyp, but it's not like a lyric sheet. It's a big freaking book.
With pictures.
With pictures. I think it should have been at least a couple pressings. And then, because just the first pressing is pretty, you know, it's pretty slim. Luckily, my brother bought it used. And so the first time that I had it, Quadrophenia, I had the book and everything.
See, I got it years later in like a milk cart of records bought from a flea market. And I didn't know that it existed until I'd got it like that.
Yeah, and it had the book because it was, first issue. So Rob was right. Quadrophenia did not have the booklet. Although they did have an outline for the story written on the album.
Yes.
Album covers.
I remember reading that while I was listening to the album.
So that was kind of like, if you can't get the... And the great thing about the book is it had all the lyrics, which is fantastic. And, but that's... I didn't even know about that kind of shit till much later on. That the act, when they reissued it, they didn't have that stuff. You know?
No, I didn't have the lyrics. I think I went out and I bought a Who songbook at the music store there. And that had about half the songs in it.
Yeah, that's funny. People might not know this, but if you wanted the lyrics of something in the pre-internet time, you actually had to buy a songbook. And a songbook was like $15. And that's a lot of money back then. $15 is a lot of money now when you want to buy a songbook. It was a lot of money then. It was about $40, I guess, in our money now.
It was like a quarter the size of a telephone book, but you didn't buy too many of them.
Or if you wanted the copy downloads, which first of all, we had to do that. And, it sounds easy to do when you talk about it, but when you're a musician and you actually have to do it, first of all, it takes forever. And second of all, there are so many mistakes you make because you think you hear a word.
Yeah.
And it's completely wrong. So thank God for the internet just for that. You can get lyrics at the touch of a button for almost anything.
I remember early when the internet came out and that we were looking up lyrics, most of them were done by people who just listened to the song and, based it. They were wrong. A lot.
They were wrong. But at least they tried, and
you... Yeah, and you could get some useful information.
Like, yes, you could get most of the song right, and it was a very good thing. And it was so startling because the time spent when we'd have to pick songs, and then you'd have to listen to them and copy them down, and you'd have to play it over and over and over again to get every single word down. Because it takes a long time to write.
Yeah, and then when you're doing it with an album, you're like picking up the needle and putting it back there a little ways and putting it down.
There's a lot of great things about the 1970s and 80s as far as analog and everything. But having to write lyrics down was not one of the fun things.
Yeah,
going back then,
or learning guitar or bass lines.
You didn't have no. And it's funny, you can look up on the internet now and you can get the exact chords, because sometimes in songbooks, they wouldn't have the right. It'd be in a different key for some reason.
Or simplified chords.
Or simplified chords that weren't actually the right ones, which happens so often.
Yep. I've played songs for years on the wrong chords. Then when you meet musicians who actually know what the song is, you can't play it because you've ingrained the other way to play it in your...
Oh, I know. It was not good times. It was not the golden age for everything.
No, that's true. But I guess you had to actually have a bit of an ear for it.
Yeah, that's one thing I didn't have. That's one thing Rob has, but I didn't have an ear for catching things. I usually had to have it written down, and that put me in trouble many a times. Because I'd have to, Rob would go, oh, no, no, it's got to be like E and F sharp minor. And I go, oh, man, like, I got to relearn the whole song. Come on, man.
Let's do something else. Let's pick another song.
That sounds like me. Oh, you know what? Let's just do something. Everybody would learn the song, and I'd go, no, let's do something else. And I don't want to learn it again. Oh, man.
Not learning it once was hard enough. Now I've got to not learn it two times. Imagine how extra frustrated you'll be.
Yes, the life of a musician. The life of a lazy musician. So now this week on our segment, I want to talk. Yeah, we got time. I think, Rob?
We got time.
I got time. I don't want to get... We might have to divide this in two, because I got things to say today. You know what?
Let's say it.
This is almost a segment of a papa. This is one of those segments. You want to do it for me?
Papa don't take no mess.
Exactly. This is I'm going to classify this as an episode of...
Papa don't take no mess.
Because I'm mad today. I'm mad.
Extra mad?
Not really.
Okay.
So I want to talk about an interview that Jan Wenner did on Mark Maron's podcast a week or two ago. And it was put up on the classic best whatever. It was put up on a website.
And you find
Best that, Classic know. Bands website, something like that. Best Classic Rock, whatever. That's where I read it. Now, if you don't know, Jan Wenner is the founder and for 50 years the editor of Rolling Stone magazine, the Bible of rock and roll. And he was doing the, a couple of weeks ago, he was doing, which would be 6 months ago for you people listening to now.
We don't take that. Back in time from the time that we are at, but you might not be.
We joke with me. We don't take that. We don't tape that far back. He was doing a publicity junket everywhere to promote his new book, which is his autobiography called Like a Rolling Stone, which I have bought actually, but have not yet read. By the time this is aired, I probably will have, because that's a whole 6 months from now. You see how I keep on bringing that up to screw with people's heads?
Time doesn't work in your world the way it does in ours.
Now, anyway, in this interview, he said that when he was head honcho of the election committee for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, that he, by the way, he started, along with like Audubon, Erdogan, and a couple of other people, he started the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm going to get to that. He said that certain bands or artists would not even be brought up for discussion, let alone even be nominated to be voted for the hall. And I found this very interesting. At first, I was outraged. I was outraged. How could you, you know, not having a band even...
I have no further information, so I have the freedom to be outraged right now.
You're going to get it in a minute, okay? Because at first I was outraged, like, oh, you're not talking about certain bands because you're prejudiced against them or something. And then he said the bands that they wouldn't talk about, or was never even mentioned, never even came up in conversations in all the 20 years that he was part of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They didn't, nobody there, which in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was a lot of big wigs. Not necessarily. I'm
going to call them corporate.
Well, I'm going to get the corporate right now. Many of the bands they didn't even talk about were corporate rock, which, oh God, I hate those bands. Oh, fuck. So there were bands like Bon Jovi, who eventually did get in, strangely enough, and had one of the worst acceptance. I gotta bring this up, Rob. So... First of all, I have to be personally, you know, I'm pretty distant to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but I like to watch it when it's on TV because it amuses me. But one of the best things I ever heard, actually, maybe the best thing I ever heard on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was when U2 was inducted and they came up and Bono, of course, who's got a big fucking mouth. Was doing a lot of the talking.
Right on.
And I have nothing against U2. I was one of the first people, and I'm not trying to blow my horn here, but I remember when their October album was released, and everybody thought they were a one-hit wonder because they had released their first album, I Will Follow, and October came out, their second album in 1981. And it kind of got dismissed. It was kind of sloppy. But I told people right then and there, I have an ear for this. I said, this band's going to be huge. I said, this band is going to... And this was an age when synthesizers were coming in with Soft Cell and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I told my friends, I did, and I keep on reminding them like 50 years, like 35 years later. Remember when I told you, I said to them, and a pretty bold statement with a band who only had one hit single at the time, and a kind of a mediocre record to follow it up. I said, this band's going to be huge. I hear something in this band. They're going to be huge. And, of course, they became U2, one of the biggest bands in the world. They let me down later on when they had this real working man's rock and roll, can save the world type of thing, which is very much my motive at the time in the 80s, which is like rock and roll can save the world. And you get up on stage and you do what you feel. And they had that for like 7-8 years. And then they turned... They made great music after that, but their whole persona was like, now we're the billionaire rock stars. And then they started preaching about stuff, about what political stuff. What
you, who are not billionaire rock stars, ought to do. Yeah, I remember that.
We won't get into that too much, but that's what turned me off to U2 and turned a lot of people off, because U2 is now one of the most hated bands ever. They went from one of the most loved bands to like one of those bands you don't admit that you like. But they still put out good music, but it's very hard. It's very hard for the common man to get associated with a band who blatantly shows excesses of, yeah, we have $300 million, which is what, you know, the kind of things they say. And, oh, they got a, you know, they're from Ireland. They're working class lads from Ireland. But, oh, they got like mansions in Miami and stuff. And they flaunt that kind of stuff. It's very hard to sympathize with a band like that. And it just shows that how, anyways, I'm going
to
get off that.
I don't accept them as having a whole lot of practical life advice to offer.
Thank you. Anyways, they said this one time, Bono came up and said, you know what, we want to thank the bands that got us here, which was Roxy Music, the New York Dolls, blah, 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 Velvet Underground. He says, these are our Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And he said, everybody should have their own Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And that stuck with me. I've never forgotten that. It's like, this didn't matter. What these guys tell you should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame doesn't mean you have to agree with it. It doesn't mean it means anything.
Many times I have not.
And many times I have. Which we'll get to the Bon Jovi thing in a minute. But it's true. Roxy Music, by the way, did get in, as did I think almost most of the bands that they had talked about, but at the time they didn't, and it was like ludicrous to me how one of the greatest bands to me, Roxy Music, who, by the way, I was going to do an article, a segment on today. They just did a 50th anniversary tour, which they say it was just as good as they've ever played, and these guys are in their 70s. And they just played a reunion tour. I just read it last week.
I believe it.
And it impressed me so much reading it. I would really love to, you know, see it on a DVD release or something. And you should have your own. Everybody should have their own Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The bands that influenced them. It can be Primus. It can be whatever you want it to be.
Secretly, we all do.
And secretly we all do, but we seem to tend to go by what the institutions tell us are the bands that should be the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. If I had my druthers, as they say.
As they used to say in the 1920s?
I would never have a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. What I would have in the 1920s... Yes, I'm a little bit too old school. I would have at the most, I would have all the 50s stars that I loved, because they are the bedrock. They are the foundation of rock and roll. And I would stop there, because once you get into 1962, you start to get into, well, you got the, of course you would have the Beatles, but then if you start putting the Beatles in, you start going like, fuck, I want the Dave Clark Five to be in there, who, by the way, for some reason are. in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I would never fucking put the Dave Clark Five in there.
Because I just think they were in there just for the fact that they were there at the British Invasion.
Yeah, I agree. I don't hear any Dave Clark Five songs on the radio at all.
No, I kind of miss that.
Never. And I didn't like them in the first place. Glad All Over, songs like that. I just fucking hated it. And I'm not saying that they're bad, but that's the point where you start to get, you know what, I should have this band in there. Oh, if you're going to have the Dave Clark Five in there, you should have this band in there. But if you cut it off and said, you know what, this is not a rock, necessarily a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but a rock and roll museum. And you put all the things that they do have in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which is like the Sgt. Pepper suit from the Beatles, and all the memorabilia and all that stuff, which makes the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame definitely worth going to see if you're a rock and roll fan. But I'm against them like making it like a baseball hall of fame or a hockey hall of fame or a football hall of fame, because those types of things are based on statistics. They're based on, like, a baseball hall of fame is based on home runs, yeah, and batting averages and all that. How do you base art to say this is better than that and should be in the hall of fame? How do you do that? How do you say this guy's statistics for selling records? Because selling records doesn't mean dick as far as artistic is concerned. Michael Bolton has sold millions and millions and millions of records. Does that mean he should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? He's not even a rock and roll artist. You can't judge art and vote on it and say these artists belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The only ones that you can legitimately say so without have any argument at all are the ones from the 50s, which I would have in there, and I'd say these are the artists that started it all, and they faced a lot of shit to play this music, and then everything else is a museum. Now, that's just my opinion, because everybody bitches about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I don't care about it. I'm amused by it, but I don't care about it, because why should I care about 500 people that I wouldn't even be allowed in their house? To even, maybe I'd be allowed to trim their gardens. And they're telling me what should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and what I should say is our Hot Rock and Roll Hall of Fame act. That goes back to my story. See, everything always does go back. I may go off track, but it has a reason. As I come back to the Bon Jovi story, I despise Bon Jovi. I don't like them. I'll admit that. And I'm glad that we don't have to rate and review any of their records, because I really don't like them. And I know that millions of people do. And I know that there are probably lots of people out there that do. That's fine. That's great. I just don't like them. And I don't think, in my personal opinion, they belong anywhere near the Hall of Fame. Maybe they can visit on a Saturday or something. But so they got inducted a couple of years ago. I can't remember when. And John Bon Jovi came up. And this is what grates me, is that these millionaire rock stars, they come up there and he starts telling literally their whole history, and you're just bored to fucking death. And it must have gone on for 45 minutes, or it seemed like it. He was telling about how they started in a band and how this guy got them signed, and then they went into the studio that day and and recorded this song. And it went on and on and on.
That's what biographical books are for.
It is. It's telling your life story in Bon Jovi terms. And I'm saying, like, I don't know. I'm just saying, like, it's so un-rock and roll to me. It's like, that's when, I remember when the Sex Pistols got into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and they wrote them a letter saying, well, we don't want to be in your Hall of Fame. And Jan Wenner read it, and he said, that's rock and roll. By saying, we don't want to be in your Hall of Fame, screw you, which he read at the ceremony, that to me was rock and roll. Being like, oh my God, these 500 men in suits voted us into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, so we're going to talk for an hour or an hour and a half, is ridiculous to me. But that's just my opinion. So anyways, Jan Wenner told me about these bands that they didn't even consider. And the bands that they didn't consider were like bands like Foreigner and REO Speedwagon and Boston and Styx, which bands, to be honest, except for a song or two here and there, I can't stand. I hate that corporate rock shit. That's the bands that we grew up with. And we used to talk about like fucking
they
corporate
were on the radio
rock
all the time, and that was all the stuff that we didn't listen to.
Oh, we didn't listen to. In fact, we railed about it all the time. We used to talk about fucking corporate rock. We don't want to be corporate rock. And I'll tell you, if you're a little bit like bemused about what the hell is corporate rock, if you weren't around at that time, because it's not used much anymore, it's really bands that are trying, or even corporations that the record companies. Maybe even saying to bands, I can't go that far, but it's bands definitely writing music that would appeal to the corporations because they could sell it really easy. You got your two verses and your choruses and your bridge and your solo, and then your last verse, or maybe going out with the chorus and having a sing-along at the end. You're making it as palatable as possible for the people out there in Radioland. Would you agree with that, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, all the music I listened to seemed to be an advancement of the previous music. It was the people were experimenting, they were doing new things, and I just expected that. And with these bands, there wasn't too much new.
There was no ingenuity involved. There was no art in it.
Polished sound, but
and that was none. It was like done over and over again to the point where it seemed like to make it so perfect. And rock and roll's not supposed to be so perfect. You're supposed to have those bum notes in there. And it's supposed to be a little bit like this, you know, a little bit like that. And yet these rock and roll acts were like making everything perfect. And making it, no 8-minute songs.
Yeah, that was definitely the kind of music I didn't want to be playing night after night.
And we still talk about that. We still talk, like Rob and I still talk about like, you know, I'd hate to be in one of those bands like Journey and Foreigner where you have to play bass like boom, boom, boom. See, that's another thing. You play your instrument with some proficiency, but not enough that you upset the public.
Yep.
With your extravagant playing. You want
to
be
nothing
good.
That draws too much attention to yourself, yes. Except for that one selling lick.
Everything is defined by the lick, because that's what people hear, and the compactness of the song itself. Anything too grandiose, taking away from that, will take away the commerciality of it. So when Jan Wenner says, we don't even consider those bands, they have never even been mentioned in our conversations about the Hall of Fame, I say, good. That brings up a point about what about the people who like it? That's why you don't have a Hall of Fame, because art can't be judged. Because whatever you don't like, there may be 10 people who do.
I realized that early on. It's all subjective.
It's subjective.
Like.
And there are bands that I don't want to name too many bands, because it's very vindictive. But there are bands that, first of all, yeah, I got to mention this. Maybe we'll talk about this next week because we're running out of time. We'll touch on this again next week. Part two.
Bands that shouldn't even be considered for the thing that we don't respect.
I just want to end it because I never want to leave something open-ended. And then I will not talk about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in these terms again. We'll just talk about bands that have been nominated and maybe or maybe not even mentioned all that much. We never really mentioned it that much on the show. But there are some things that I would like to say, but I really don't. If I started, then we wouldn't get to the album until like the 1 hour mark. So that would defeat the purpose.
Unless we have a really quick album.
But I like those. I like those comments by Jan Wenner. But somebody else might find that extremely bigoted towards those bands. It's a personification of why it's such a bad idea. Art should not have a Hall of Fame. And there are more Hall of Fames than rock and roll. There's a Country Music Hall of Fame. I'd assume there's a lot of music Hall of Fames out there.
Yeah, I realized a long time ago that people, they get good at what they do and they get as proficient and as good as they're going to get. And then there's not a best or worst. They just get different.
Yeah.
They just get unique.
What more do you want? What more do you want when you're a successful musician? Now it's a big deal. Like, the artists really want to get in the Hall of Fame. Like, I remember, we go back, we're long on a tooth. We remember when there wasn't even a Hall of Fame, so there wasn't anything to be excited about. And there wasn't even all that, you know, the rock bands that you like or artists that you like weren't nominated for Grammys and shit like that.
Yeah.
So you got nothing. What did you need? You had girls, you had blow.
You had M&Ms with all the brown ones M&Ms, removed.
You had millions of dollars. You had chauffeurs. And we're talking about the big bands. Of course, I'm not talking about the working bands that go out there and play in the clubs all the time. I mean, do you, it's just like the Academy Awards. You know what the Academy Awards are? They're you're giving awards to millionaires. That's that, if, yeah, imagine if somebody told you, hey, you know what's on TV tonight? The show where they're giving awards to these multimillionaires. You know what your reaction would be if you first heard that? You'd go, why would I watch that kind of show? That would get me mad. No, it's the Oscars. And you go, oh, yeah. It's like, why do they need, they already get like these actors that they give. See, I'm going on a rant, which I shouldn't.
I don't mind the awards going to actors if they've done work that I appreciate and like, but a lot of movies that they're
in. Why do you need an award for that? You're getting paid $3 million or whatever.
Need.
Why do you need recognition if you know it's a good job? Plus, again, with the Academy Awards or with the Grammy Awards or any awards that have to do with art, you're judging art. You're saying that guy's performance in that movie is better than that guy's. I think it gets written up, and that's great. I love it when somebody says, I love the performance in so-and-so film. We were talking about this today. Just the conversation when we were talking about our favorite Columbo episodes, and we were talking about the brilliant direction in one of them, and we're talking about the great acting in some of them, and how that does get written about in blogs and columns. That's all you need. You don't need an award for that.
Who was it? Was it Anne Murray? She never showed up for any award show. No, she never acknowledged any of them in any way.
No.
I respected that.
I do respect that too. Woody Allen never, and I know Woody Allen is kind of a name that, you know, you can't really mention whatever. Nowadays. But he never showed up for any of his awards because he thought it was bullshit. And of course, we have George C. Scott, who refused his Oscar because he said competition is stupid in art. And I agree. If I ever, yes. when I never will, get nominated for an award, but if I did, I would decline it.
Art doesn't exist to beat up the other art.
No. You don't go, this Picasso is better than this Picasso. That's your opinion. Somebody could think that Picasso that you dislike and just voted the great. Imagine voting a painting, the greatest painting of like this year or whatever.
I start getting subcategories like greatest ear in a painting.
I think you're getting the point of, if you really think about it, how ludicrous it is. And if you sell an album like a Beyonce that sells 5 million copies, what the fuck do you care if you get an award that says you got best album?
Yeah, I've never understood the actual accepting an award and thanking people for, well, you did what you wanted to do.
Your point is right, Rob. Whether your album sells 5 million copies or 5,000, it's the process of making the album and making people happy who bought it. And you should, if you are able to sell 5 million copies of your album, that should be enough. You don't need, with all your millions of dollars, an award. And there are people who get really mad when they don't get nominated. Oh my God, like I'm going, like I could give a shit. I seriously do. I could give a shit if I got nominated for anything. I could care less. And Rob knows I'd probably be the last one there. And I know that Rob wouldn't be there either.
What's the point of my being there? If I was there, it would mean that I'm up to something. That's all it would mean.
You'd be there for the food. Anyway, we got to leave that because...
it's time to move on. And next week, we shall continue.
We shall continue with our rant. It's turned into my rant that turned into our rant.
Yeah, Papa didn't take no mess.
No, Papa's really mad. He's going to give you one right in the bum. So today's album we are going to review is by the band Sweet and their 1974 album Desolation Boulevard. Very similar to what I would call the street where we tape this show. See, there's my joke.
You knew you'd written it in there.
I knew I had it in
there. You just forgot
somewhere.
Where you put it.
Now, Sweet's a very strange band as far as their history is concerned. Not so far as the music. But first of all, like they started... this is a very inconsequential point.
I need some history because I couldn't find too much on the... by looking at their discography.
You know what? Because that's not your job.
But I was curious.
Now, They're actually one of the first bands I ever heard of, to be honest with you, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But they started off, and I didn't know this. I didn't know this at all, because in North America, they've always been called Sweet.
Yeah.
Right. But when they started, their first albums were The Sweet, which I didn't know. And of course, they're very... they started off as more of a teeny bopper glam rock band. And before I get into the biography, because it's not very interesting, to be honest with you, because nobody's going to know whose names I'm going to be saying, I don't think, unless you're a big Sweet fan. But I will get to that. I'm going to tell you the why I heard Sweet as one of the very first bands ever. First of all, they were very popular in like 74, 75 with the kids in school because, I don't know, it just was rock and roll, kind of a hard rock and roll that wasn't played that often on AM radio. And it had that teenager type vibe. You know what I mean, Rob? Like, I always want to say Blitzkrieg Bop for some reason. By the Ramones, but I mean Ballroom Blitz.
Well, that last song on the first side, the chorus there, reminded me of Blitzkrieg Bop. Oh, yeah, I did.
Man, I should have never brought that up. So you got the Ballroom Blitz, and then you got, like, Fox on the Run. And they just appealed because they had this real rock and roll energy to them, and the kids really liked them. And they weren't, they didn't seem at that time, even though it wasn't dangerous, like, they were not... Even though they dressed up, they weren't feminine. Like if you like David Bowie,
no, these were definitely the grittier end of glam.
The grittier rock, end, yeah. and they were kind of safe because it wasn't like you were liking a band that was over androgynous. Even though they kind of did dress up, they were kind of more like the rock and roll that got played on the radio, and they weren't like the freaky bands that you get made fun of.
Yeah, they
school.
Definitely had a the straight ahead kind of rock sound rather than
yes,
the
exactly they did, and it wasn't mixed in with a lot of strange meanings or anything like that. They were a pretty straight ahead rock and roll band that decided that glam was the way to go. And I just remember the first there was this dance that we had. I can't remember what year, 75, maybe 76 at the latest. And they were setting up for this dance, and it was for the older kids in junior high.
Yeah.
We were in elementary. And I'll tell you, in our school, we had, as Rob will tell you, we had the big gym and we had the small gym. Remember, Rob?
Yes.
Now, the big gym was called the big gym.
That's one of the beauties of the English language. If we were talking French, that'd be much longer.
It was not like the Louis Saint Laurent gym or anything like that.
Did it get to the advancement of athletics?
Big gym, that's what it was. And the small gym, ta-ta, was called the small gym. So yeah. whenever you went for gym class, they would always go, okay, today we're going to the small gym. They would never say, like, it was never called anything. You know, it was just a small gym.
None of us ever had any trouble finding or differentiating between the two of them.
And the big gym was big. It was big.
It was big. It had a stage, I remember.
It had a stage and everything. So they're setting up in the big gym. It's so funny because the big gym, we would say it almost every day that it becomes almost like you don't know what the big gym is. Like, I say it almost like it's one word nowadays because said it for like 50 years almost. So... I was in elementary school, and they were setting it up for a dance for the junior high students. So I don't know, at least this is a long freaking time ago, but I just remember I was straggling in there. Maybe it was after school, and they were like setting it up. So I decided to sit down and find out what was going on. So I sat down, and they played. They were testing the light systems, you know, turning it off and then testing the...
Making sure all the wiring was running.
Yes, and the song they played, and it's the first song I ever heard in like loud music because they played it all over they were testing like Fox on the Run. And I'm telling you, I thought it was the greatest thing. I had never heard music that loud. Dude, and it just came bolting from this huge speaker system.
When you first hear like coming out of a big system and it actually vibrates your body.
Yes.
I never got that at home.
And this is the first time it happened because all I've been listening to music at that time was the radio when I would go to school. And, you know, your parents would play it on the radio or whatever. or at home on the radio, I'd never heard music coming from like a whole auditorium, which was kind of like what the big gym was, blasting out like that. And I can still remember that day, and it was like 45 years ago. And I just sat there, and these guitars just came like, and then I'm trying to think of the song now. You went with Rear. Now I'm thinking of the April Wine song.
There was Fox on the Run, and Ballroom Blitz was the other one.
Yeah, Fox on the Run, and it was just sounded so fucking magnificent to me, and the hardness of it, like the great crunch that the guitars had, and that's why Sweet was popular. That's why they put on Sweet as a test song for the dance that night. Of course, they were going to play it that night. But that's a great song to test your sound system and to get the kids going. I mean, Sweet was a popular band.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget that. That was probably my reawakening, or my initial awakening to rock and roll, was hearing, wow, rock and roll like that loud is brilliant. Like the chords coming in, and then hey.
It has an attractive quality. It draws you into the sound. You want more of it. That's
why I wanted more
show
of
up
it.
At the dance. And
I wanted more of it. I heard that and I said, play everything through this system. And of course, I think, you know, they turned the lights on and I kind of got out after they played the song. But I was thinking, man, this rock and roll's got something. It took a year or two more. But I just remember, wow, that was an overpowering experience. And I've never forgotten that. And I've always associated it with Sweet. So they do have a little bit of a soft spot in my heart. Now, Sweet actually was initially called The Sweet Shop. Not a great name. Like, Sweet alone is not a great name as far. It's a great name if you're a band that they were. Which is... kind of your rock and roll glam, but you also want the kids, you know, the 12-year-olds to listen to you. Sweet's not a bad name. The Sweet. It's not a great name. And I'm sorry, I'm pretty good at names. I'm good at album covers, which album covers are good for bands. All that kind of ephemeral stuff that people think, you know, don't mean anything. It means a lot to, I know, me and Rob, because... it just does. Like, if you want to be a successful band, you should have a proper name. But Sweet does actually is a good name for this band, because yeah. That's the kind of music they play.
Especially if you take the away from it. So
right, Sweet. Exactly. I like that a lot. Sweet. More. Their music's sweet. It's nice. It's rock and roll, but it's meant for the kids. It's not meant to be taken seriously. You don't want it to be a really heavy name. All these things were important. So they got the perfect name for the type of music they play. Not a great name if you're trying to be an art rock critical darling like Roxy Music. That's a great name for a band. Roxy Music, for the type of music that you have to pick a name that's good for the type of music you play. And it consisted of, Sweet consisted of lead vocalist Brian Connolly, bass player Steve Priest, guitarist Andy Scott, and drummer Mick Tucker, who was there very much there almost through the whole time, except for one or two changes. I think Andy Scott, a guitarist, is maybe the only one. Oh, Brian Connolly is still alive. No, he's not. pretty much Andy Scott, who does tour as Andy Scott and Sweet, is the only member still alive, unfortunately. I mean, that's something that when we do any band from the 70s, pretty much from now on is what we're going to be talking about.
I look in their discography on the Spotify and I see Desolation Boulevard, and then not much until 1991 or 92.
Well, that's not right. Because they released like in 77. I remember they had nobody heard from them for quite a while. And then 78, they had like Love is Like Oxygen, which I loved that song when it first came out. I don't think I like it too much now. For some reason, but at the time,
that was one of the first songs that when I was in high school, a guitarist learned and was playing
on
the guitar.
That's true.
Was
like, I remember kind of hearing that when we were in high school, coming from the thing. Had a great lick, and I loved how it was very unsweet. Like, it was a little bit more mature, and it had the part where the keyboard came in, and it was very soft. I'm wrong. I really do like that song.
I like that
song.
I went straight to that song when we heard it. I had to hear that one.
Actually made me.
I got into the album.
My favorite Sweet song, because it showed a maturity and how the band Went with the Times.
The other song I was looking at their greatest hits that I didn't realize was Sweet, I hadn't heard in a long time, was Little Willie.
Oh, really?
I did not know that was Sweet.
Little Willie, Willie won't go home. Actually, I didn't know that till a couple of years ago. But it does sound like Sweet when you mention it. Like, oh, yeah, that's Sweet.
Yeah, you have to be told, but then it did get you clicks in. Yeah.
That's the kind of music that they made, especially with their first two albums, which Little Willie is from, it's very much kind of appeals to the 12 and 13-year-old, but still with a rock and roll glam edge to it. Their musical style actually, during 1971 and 1972, followed a progression from the Archies-like bubblegum style to a Who-influenced rock style. It was kind of like the Archies mixed with the Who, which is actually a pretty good combination when you think of it. The hard guitars and the kind of like bubblegum lyrics. And of course, they were always known for their high-pitched backing vocals, even going as far with "Love Is Like Oxygen."
The fact, these guys, they can all sing.
Yeah, they can all sing.
They're good at the harmonies.
It's funny they kept that for "Oxygen," which is a very. I actually remember the first time I heard "Love Is Like Oxygen," and I didn't know who it was.
No.
And I said, "This is a fantastic song." And of course, it was edited. The later song that I heard later on FM was 6 minutes long, which is. Even better, but it was very moody, which is not something you usually get. You know, it had that very soft verse part, but then it goes, "Love is like oxygen," and they have that sweet high voice.
Yeah.
And you're right, Rob. I don't know why I said I don't like it anymore. I really don't know why I said that, because it's actually my favorite Sweet song. But so one of the songs, they had a whole bunch of songs in 73, 74, 72, 73, 74 that were kind of bubblegum pop. One of them was Ballroom Blitz, which I've always kind of thought it's a nice song. It didn't affect me like other people thought. It was
I listen to it now and I really do like the playing in that song.
Yeah, I do like playing in the song. Like, it's a little bit too poppy to me, a little bit too kids for me.
Yeah.
And that whole, and hey, Steven, that's a little bit too. Yeah, you know, I don't like that, but I did like it at the time when I was a kid. I really did. And then the band turned to a more hard rock style after their second album with their mid-career singles from 74 and 75, which was Turn It Down, which I have not heard. And of course, Fox on the Run, which I think maybe is their most popular song. Who knows?
When I just look on the Spotify, that had twice as many listeners.
Oh, there you go. So Fox on the Run is their most popular song. And it did reach number 2 on the UK charts. They also achieved, and this is, I think, for North America, I can't be definite because I wasn't around listening to music at the time, but I think Little Willie, it says here, is top 10 hit. That might be later, even though it was released first. It might have been one of those...
The sleeper hit.
That after they became successful, they released that song again, but I might be wrong. And of course, Love Is Like Oxygen, as it says here that I'm reading, even though I don't really have to read it to know. I just want to... That was their big songs. Little Willie, The Ballroom Blitz, Fox on the Run, and Love Is Like Oxygen were really... everybody knew those songs. Everybody knew those songs. Maybe not Little Willie for us, because Ballroom Blitz and Fox on the Run, until Love Is Like Oxygen, were the two songs they played all the time on the radio. And Little Willie, they did, but I just don't think that we knew that it was them.
No, I didn't draw the connection.
And actually, Rob is right. Sweet did have their last hit with Love Is Like Oxygen, which is too bad because it looks like they were turning the corner into another area, more serious rock and roll. But Connolly left the group in 1979 to start a solo career right after that. And the remaining members continued as a trio until 1981, and then that was it for Sweet. And then they would, that was basically it. Then people started to die, and which is sad.
Damn it.
We don't mean to belittle that. We're not joking about it, but that's something that unfortunately happens almost every week on this show, because we should have done this show 10 years ago. But that's...
And then we get some good interviews.
But, you know, that's just, you know, it's funny how these people that started in the early 70s, they are getting to be 70, you know. These people, that's just, you know, it's funny how time just goes so fast. Anyways, that's basically the biography of Sweet. They're kind of a they're not a very dynamic band as far as you know the members, or they have a great fantastic story. They were just a working band who did their stuff. Not much of a backstory there. So we'll another point I just want to make that's important to know before we review this album is that almost all of their albums were different from England, from Europe, to North America.
I listened to the North American version of this album.
Yeah,
that's the one I grew up with.
We listened to the North American version because mainly that's the only version that is...
We had access to.
And secondly, that's the version that everybody kind of knows now. It's funny because it didn't happen too often. It happened a lot in the 60s, as everybody knows, with the Stones and the Who and the Kinks and the Beatles, how they would have different songs for different albums and they'd exchange songs. And for some reason, and they used to do that with bands like Sweet in the 70s, who were not album-oriented bands. They were singles bands, and they didn't exactly appeal to the art rock or the critics type of level. They were more for the kids. So exchanging songs from album to album doesn't seem that strange to me. It does seem strange for the 70s because usually it wasn't done that much anymore by the 70s, but they did it with every album. No. It wasn't just trust me.
The only other one I think that we reviewed that they did that in the 70s, we were talking about, it was Paul McCartney.
A Band on the Run.
Band on the Run, which had the additional track.
They have done it. We have, there has been a couple of albums we did where they had changed the, or added the song or for North, but I'm talking about almost a total overhaul. Like with Desolation Boulevard, there's only two or three songs I think that are similar on each release. And that's very strange. And that's goes through a lot of Sweet's catalog up until they did like their album. I don't know which album it is that they did Love Is Like Oxygen, but it was almost every album that they would just track. So if you're talking about the Desolation Boulevard album in the UK, it has, which I think is not considered.
It has 8 songs rather than 10.
Yeah, and there's only about 3 that I think overlap. So they're almost 2 different albums. But it's not, I don't know, it's just, now this is the album. The North American version is considered the Desolation Boulevard album. Level Headed was the album with Love Is Like Oxygen, is what I was trying to say. So, I just want to point out, their approach by the time they got to Level Headed with Love Is Like Oxygen was more into the Electric Light Orchestra, which I agree with. Anyways, we're going to get to the album, Desolation Boulevard. I really like this album. It was fun. I actually like this album. Oh, she's 63 minutes. 1 hour. Okay. we haven't even reviewed the album yet.
We're already an hour's review in 5 minutes.
I like this album from first listen, and I'm finding myself almost never liking albums on first listen anymore. It's starting to be more of a given now. Maybe it always was, but I never noticed it before because we never had to review albums until 4 years ago. It really takes a listen or two before I start to settle in. But this one was fun from the first time I listened to it last week. And I don't know, there was something really good about it. Like, I don't know, it has some good lyrics. I have to admit, like, a lot of their songs are written by the songwriting team of Mike Chapman and Nicky Chinn. Mike Chapman is known for the person behind Susie Quattro and other people, where he would produce them and write songs for people like that, kind of rock and roll, but kind of also for young kids. So he wrote a lot of songs on here, that songwriting team, and then there'd be a couple written by the band. I'm trying to get to the American release. You know, starts out with Ballroom Blitz, and I like the songs The 16s because it is about 16s,
I was saying,
but it's also about being 16. So I like the double entendre of 16s is what the song is about. Every verse is about two different teens. That's why you get 16s, and it's about being 16. And I really liked the song. It was really this song. The first side is really strong.
It is.
I love No You Don't. And by the way, the first side is written by Chapman and Chin completely. I love the song AC/DC, which, by the way, there was no AC/DC.
Yeah, when I was listening to it as a younger fella, I had not heard too much about these ladies who liked other ladies.
Yeah, it was an interesting song. Actually, very catchy. All these songs are extremely catchy on the first side, especially. I Want to Be Committed, which sounds like a Ramones song, but it's also...
Just in the chorus, it has a bit of a rhythmic.
Yeah, they're very rhythmic, this whole album, basically, is very rhythmic, very fun. It's just a fun album.
There's a bunch of the songs, they start off with just maybe one or two instruments going along with the vocals. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they kick in. The next time they do that verse, it's like the whole band charging ahead. That they kind of reminded me a bit of grunge, where they'd have a soft verse and a hard chorus, and then soft verse and hard chorus. But this was just
I never thought of that grunge before, but I totally agree with what you say now that you bring it up.
Yeah, and this only differs in that it's usually just the first or one verse that they do soft, and the rest of it is full tilt, straight ahead.
Oh, exactly. And there's no ballads. This is all rock and roll from beginning to end. And to bring up your point, like in Ballroom Blitz, where it just has the bass in the middle.
I was listening to that, and I realized he plays with a pick.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, I can see when you're a musician, you can tell that kind of stupid stuff. I noticed that too. And then you hear the bass drum playing, and then the band comes in. Yeah, it's almost that part that I like, which is not only dynamics, but that expectation about what's going to come next. Is it going to fade out like that, or is it going to bring it up? And I love when things are low and then come back
and
up.
Really imaginative musical work. The drums and the guitars are really grabbing my ear with the transitions.
It's fun. And you know, the songs aren't 2 minutes long. They have to hold your interest for most of these songs are 4 minutes or longer, and they do.
Was it in No You Don't, the solo there?
That's a great song.
They're just playing rhythm guitar for a lot of it, but building it slowly over the solo, and then they had that keyboard.
Yeah. Yes. I like that. I really love the first side, especially. Just really rocking and just love it. And then the first song on side two, Sweet F.A., of course you can understand what that means. Written by the band, and 6 minutes long. You wouldn't know it's 6 minutes long. It's really good. I still think it's 4 minutes long because it just goes so fast.
It's got that straight ahead guitar.
Very good lyrics. I have to say that for a band that is not trying to be artistic, yes, and they're not trying to. They're attracting a young crowd. They're not trying to attract to the Roxy Music type of crowd or the King Crimson type of crowd. That their lyrics are still not throwaways. None of these lyrics are throwaways. They're either fun or they're very good.
And I didn't have to go to any lyrics website. I could hear them all clearly just from listening to the album.
Yeah, I agree. First time I heard, as I told everybody, and Rob knows, I always listen the first time I listen to it without lyrics.
Oh.
And most of the time when I listen to an album, I don't get a lot of lyrics. At least clearly. This one I did. I didn't need much help. And when I did look it up, it was pretty much what I had thought it was that they had said. So Sweet F.A. I really liked. And then the band again wrote Fox on the Run. And I have to say, there's two versions of Fox on the Run. One is the long version, which is about a minute and 10 seconds longer. And then there's this version. The single version, in my opinion, is killer. The Fox on the Run, which is... The single version is 3.5 minutes, and which is the one on the album. And it's funny to call it the album version, but the one on the English album is 4 minutes and 40 seconds long. And this is perfect at 3 minutes and 30 seconds. This is such a great song. And it's got such a great everything about it. Vocals and Fox on the Run. I always thought it was a literal fox, but it was, of course, a woman fox.
A foxy lady.
A foxy lady. Here I am 40 years later thinking, oh, it's not, they're actually not chasing a fox.
It's an English band. They chase foxes from time to time. They all get on horses and wear funny clothes.
It just shows how powerful the music is that I didn't care what the lyrics were. I really didn't. Fox on the Run, it could have been Jew on the Run. I don't mean anything by that, but you know what I mean? Like, I didn't
dolphin
care.
Dolphin on the Moon.
Yeah, Dolphin on the Moon. Like, whatever. I was then as a kid, and I am now totally drawn to the music, totally drawn by the vocals and the chorus vocals by everybody in the band. Just the highlight of the album by far, and just the... One of the two highlights from the band in general, you know, Fox on the Run and Love Is Like Oxygen, just one of the best songs of the 50s for just rock and roll fun. You know, I just loved it. And I just think that the last three songs are not bad, but they're written by members of the band. And it's just, I just didn't think that they were up to snuff from the first seven songs.
No, writing wise, I didn't. But playing wise, musicianship.
Oh
wise,
yeah, I
damn.
Agree. I agree. There is not one song that is not played really good. But you can't mask a not very good written song, even with the best of musicians.
You can only do so much.
And I tell you.
And the best I can say for those three songs is they're not bad. They're just not memorable.
No, they're not memorable. The one thing I do remember from a song called "Into the Night." Which I wrote a song called "Into the Night," by the way, and it was very good. But the one song about "Into the Night" didn't really have anything to do with "Into the Night" except him saying it. It was actually not bad lyrics. But then he would put in "Into the Night," and you were realizing that he was just putting it in because it sounded good.
It sounded good and needed some lyrics.
And needed some lyrics, and that was very disappointing to me. That was kind of like. Either being trying to be commercial or just trying to be lazy.
Sloughing off
a little bit. And and the other song, Set Me Free in Solid Gold Brass, again, like Rob said, great playing, but the songs just weren't up to snuff of the first seven. Not that they were bad, but they just weren't memorable like the first seven were.
And I remember playing that first side quite a bit, and the only one I kind of had to relearn was I Want to Be Committed.
First side is just killer.
All the rest of them I remember and I love. I was singing the chorus for the 16s about 2 weeks before you even mentioned.
That's such a great song.
Before we even mentioned we were doing this, I was riding my bike to work. Life goes on, you know, it ain't easy. Love that chorus.
And I do. I love that chorus. I love the words in the 16s. I love everything about it. I love how it has a hook, like all their songs have hooks. They have great hooks. Chapman and Chin, who, like I said before, wrote for many other acts. Susie Quattro, who we'll be spotlighting very shortly on this show, was one they wrote so many songs for. Who was not Pinky Tuscadero? Leather Tuscadero on Happy Days.
Oh, okay.
If people don't remember that. And
there was a Pinky Tuscadero, and didn't she have a little brother?
She had a little sister, Leather Tuscadero, and that was Susie Quattro.
Okay.
Yeah, and we'll be doing an album very soon, next year. Beginning of next year, sometime.
Which could be happening any time.
You don't know when we tape people. We got to hurry up because we don't want to have
Maybe
the longest...
Maybe we're taping these songs after you hear them or taking these shows.
We don't want to have the longest show ever because we just don't, okay? That's not something we strive for. But I agree with Rob. The 16s are just, oh my God. Like the songs on the first side, even when they're goofy, like AC/DC is still not really goofy. It's still very smart, very smartly played. I give this album a strong 4 stars. It's a fun album. I like it. This band actually plays really well. They probably deserved better than just being known as a bubblegum singles group. But maybe that had to do with changing song orders for every album and their record company not looking as their albums at all sell that important. If your album gets songs changed from the UK to North America, and they don't
That's
seem
the
to
record
care.
Company
it
saying.
Kind of shows to the band, to the fans, that hey, I guess you don't care about your albums, what songs are on there, and that kind of makes you a singles band. And but they're a fun band. I've liked Sweet since I was 11 years old, if not younger. And Yeah, I was surprised. I've never heard a Sweet album. Always heard their songs on the radio, like I said, since we were kids. But I've never heard a Sweet album, and I was very pleasantly surprised. I thought it would be pretty bubblegummy, and it wasn't. And that's why I give it a strong 4 stars.
It was a rockin'.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was between 4 and 4.5, because it's 7/10 of it are really enjoyable, and 3/10 are not bad. But yeah. It's the 3/10 that prevented from...
I don't even know what that 3/10 would be like if it wasn't compared to the other 7/10. Yeah. You know, and you never know that.
But, you know, yeah, when you do an album, you're going to experiment, and some of those experiments work and others don't, and they were a whole lot more hit than miss on
the And song. You know when it's put at the end of the album like that, almost like you blow your load for 7 songs.
Yeah.
That you know that even the band knows, or either the record company knows when they're sequencing the album that, okay, we'll put these 3 on the end when everybody's already heard the good stuff.
If they
stuff.
Work, they work.
Yeah. Yeah. And if they like it, they like it, but we don't like it. And so you kind of know when you stick songs at the end that, oh, they heard the good songs already, and maybe they'll like these, maybe they won't, I don't know, but we don't.
It so doesn't kinda, cost us anymore. Put them right. on.
So 4 and 4.5. I'll say
I'm 4.5.
There. Yeah, I'm going to say Rob said 4.5. We hide it. We recommend it. if you're into rock and roll, fun rock and roll and glam rock. We recommend this album. It was highly enjoyable from first listen too, yeah. Which is strange for an album that we listen to. Anyways,
I think my sister had this years ago, and that was when I got a chance to listen to it, and I enjoyed it
back
then.
This is a sister's type band in a good way.
I knew I was going to enjoy listening to it this time. I'd forgotten how much I enjoyed listening
this
to
is not
it.
Can I just want to say this real quick, because I don't want to have the longest show, but this is an album that your sister would buy, but just because it's a teeny bopper type of band in kind of, I don't know. I don't want to get too complicated.
Maybe songwriting stuff, but...
It would be more a female would buy at 13 than a guy would buy at 13. That's all I'm saying. The guy might buy it when he's 17.
These guys rock hard enough and well enough that definitely appeals to the guys.
Oh, yeah. It's not a teeny bopper band, really.
Yeah.
But that's the image they brought, and that was kind of like... You would expect your sister to buy it before you would, because they're not cool. They're a singles band. But there's a lot more to Sweet than their image. I think we should end it on that, because I think that says it all.
I got nothing further to say.
And I don't even want to end the show. I don't want to end it. Okay. So that's it for today's show. Now, next week, we'll have another glam rock artist that will be highlighted and reviewed. And I think you're going to like that one. It's going to be cool. It's going to be fun. Rob doesn't know what it is.
Well, after we're done the show, I'm going to take a guess at who it is.
Okay, I'm gonna tell you next week whether Rob got it right or not. Okay, it'll be part of our odds and ends.
We got 2 more albums to do, so I think the band I'm gonna name will be one of the 2 albums that we still got left to do, right?
Yeah, you know what one of them is, Rob. I know you know what one of the bands are. I'm just wondering if you know what next week's bands are. So until then, everybody, we did not break the longest show ever. Thank God. Sorry, it was so long. It was really the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing. We'll continue.
We get carried away. We get all angry and excited. And
so until next week, everybody, take care and stay safe. I just write her off.